chair, a guy at the bar chatting up a young woman spilling out of a dress a couple of sizes too small, caught her eye and gave a little wave. Katie nodded back politely and turned back to Reese, rolling her eyes. Ugh, that guy is the worst. Reese shifted his eyes from Katie to the Romeo at the bar, recognizing him as a cable news personality, light on substance and heavy on hair products.
Not to be gossipy,
she said conspiratorially,
but he is such a creep.
Reese raised an eyebrow.
That girl is a new producer, about a year out of college. Guess how he met his third and current wife, who is at home with the kids.
Producer, Reese ventured.
Exactly.
Doesn't he have a book out?
Oh, yes. A New York Times bestseller. Guess how that happened?
No idea.
You need to suffer through an evening of cable news. That should be all you need to figure it out. I wouldn't mind as much if he wasn't so slimy. I refuse to even do his show. It's guys like him that make me seriously consider getting out of the news business.
Sounds like a real treat.
On to more pleasant topics. How was your week?
Katie asked, knowing Reese would have to be guarded about his final weeks at Camp Peary.
Are all those grad school co-eds behaving themselves?
The CIA's Camp Peary was commonly known as the world's most exclusive dating service. Recruits were typically in their mid to late 20s with graduate degrees from the nation's most elite bastions of academia. That they were under intense pressure for the better part of a year and were restricted from talking about their training with anyone outside the circle made for some intense relationships. The farm was responsible for more than a few marriages, as well as a slew of divorces. Katie was familiar with government agencies as one of the most recognizable journalists in the Beltway due to her book about the embassy annex attack in Benghazi, aptly titled The Benghazi Betrayal. Katie had interviewed a host of current and former CIA staff officers and contractors. Her exposé on the conspiracy to kill Reese's team in the mountains of Afghanistan by a cabal of government-connected financiers only raised her profile as one of the country's most respected investigative journalists.
Well, it was, interesting.
Oh, do tell,
Katie teased.
I met with the president on Tuesday.
So have you decided? Want an appetizer? Katie dropped her menu on her plate.
You what? You mean he came down from D.C. to address your class?
No, I mean he sent a helicopter and flew me up to Camp David. What do you think, calamari or caprese?
Are you serious? What did he want?
That's classified. I think I'll start with the carpaccio. Salads look good, too. I love this place.
James! How long were you there?
About 24 hours. Did you know that Brezhnev almost crashed a Lincoln with Nixon in the passenger seat joyriding around the perimeter?
I was not aware,
Katie said, suddenly serious. What are you thinking for your main? Filets here are fantastic.
James Reese. The President of the United States does not just summon a CIA recruit to Camp David to give him what I'm sure is a fascinating history.
Reese put down his menu and looked into the deep blue eyes of the woman with whom he'd fallen in love.
True. He wanted to discuss the events in Odessa. He said he might not even be in the seat if it hadn't been for Freddie saving President Grimes.
Reese felt more than a tinge of guilt for not telling Katie the whole truth, but what was he supposed to say? The President of the United States got himself elected to the highest office in the land to wage a personal war of retribution against those he believed helped facilitate the attacks of 9/11 that killed his fiancée?
Did he ask you about Russia?
Interestingly enough, that didn't come up. Did you know that FDR and Churchill planned D-Day there?
I did know that,
Katie acknowledged, still skeptical. Their waiter interrupted just in time.
Have you decided?
He asked. What are the specials tonight? Reese asked, trying to draw out the disruption. He smiled at Katie, who shook her head, knowing exactly what he was doing.
Men could be so transparent.
They ordered appetizers and main courses, handing their menus back to the waiter, before leaning back toward one another to continue their conversation.
Change of topic, Reese declared. What have you been up to this week?
Well, I most certainly did not meet privately with the president, but I am in the middle of a fascinating investigation that my friend Haley Garrett is helping me with.
Isn't she the one that works at the CDC? Reese asked, using the acronym for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
That's her. We were roommates at Davis before I changed my major and transferred to Berkeley. She was on the pre-med track, always talking about wanting to work with Doctors Without Borders, which she eventually did. She volunteered with them in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It changed her.
How so? Reese asked, taking a sip of his wine, remembering how Africa gets in your blood.
She was always a free spirit, but seeing so many people, particularly children, die of malaria, Ebola, Zika, cholera, yellow fever, even bubonic plague, took her down a different path. She came back and got a master's in public health and did a residency in internal medicine. She's now at the CDC specializing in infectious diseases.
I'm glad somebody does it, Reese said.
As you may or may not have noticed, I have been devoting columns to Russian government mafia collusion.
I hadn't noticed, Reese responded with a hint of sarcasm. They'd had more than a few conversations on the subject, Reese advising her against poking the bear and Katie standing strong for the principles of her profession. It was her way of fighting back. When the Bratva tried to kill them both in Montana, Reese went to guns. Katie's weapons were her words and her platform.
Haley and I were talking about that very same thing.
What did she say?
She sounded an awful lot like you, Mr. Reese,
Katie said, swirling her wine in her glass and holding it up to the candlelight. Before changing majors, Katie had been in the viticulture and enology program at UC Davis. She knew her wines. I like her already. Their appetizers arrived, and Reese dug into the carpaccio while Katie picked at the caprese, choosing her next words carefully.
She also said something that got me thinking.
And what was that?
When she was in the Congo, they heard about a village a couple hundred miles northeast where there had been an outbreak of hemorrhagic fever.
Like Ebola?
Yes. What do you know about it?
We did some training in bio and chemical weapons in the teams in case we were ever tasked with hitting a WMD facility. Did some full mission profile exercises out on a base in Utah that's set up for that type of scenario. Not a mission any of us were dying to do. Other than that, just what I read in the hot zone. True story, if I remember correctly.
That's right. It was about a scare they had just down the street in Reston, Virginia, back in 1989. They contained it. It didn't get out of control. Anyway, she told me that they had heard rumors of Russian military advisors working in the area. When I heard that, I put my reporter hat on.
And?
Russian arms dealers and advisors have been going in and out of Africa for a generation. It is one of the least talked about battlegrounds of the Cold War, so that wasn't surprising. What was surprising were the other rumors.
Other rumors?
That the Russians had been using villages as test subjects for their bioweapons programs since the early 60s.
Test subjects?
I hadn't really thought about it before, so I did my research. Between 1976 and 2020, there were 28 documented hemorrhagic fever outbreaks in Africa. All were assumed to be natural occurrences. Typically, the World Health Organization and various NGOs go in to treat infected people, take samples, and conduct research. There are firsthand reports of Congolese soldiers massacring entire villages and burning them to the ground to control the spread.
I hate to say this, but that's not shocking. Human life tends to have a different value in certain parts of the world.
And sometimes in our very own part of it,
Katie concluded. Though it had not been her intent, Reese's memories flashed back to the smiling faces of his young daughter and beautiful wife. Very true, Reese said, looking into the cherry red wine in his glass.
When Haley and her team arrived at the village the following day, do you know what they found?
I hate to even speculate.
Nothing.
Nothing.
The village had been incinerated. Not just burned to the ground, but wiped off the map.
You said that was common practice.
Yes, but Haley said this was different. There was a huge crater where the village should have been, and the jungle was a charred ruin for what seemed like miles in every direction.
A crater? From a bomb?
That's what she said.
Did she get any pictures?
They did, but it was back before everything was cloud-based. On their way back to Kinshasa, they were stopped at a roadblock. They were accused of being spies. She swears there were Russian mercenaries assisting the indigenous military personnel manning the checkpoint. All their phones, cameras, and computers were confiscated. They were ordered out of the country the following day.
They're lucky they weren't killed. African dictators don't mess around over there, Reese said, remembering his own experience with Rafe working on a hunting concession back in their college days.
I did a little more digging. What she's describing could have been the result of an FAE.
A fuel air explosive?
That's right. Do you know how they work?
I don't have much experience with them, but I've seen video of some tests the Air Force did at China Lake. Huge canister dropped by a parachute. If memory serves, an initial charge disperses the fuel over the target, and then multiple secondary charges ignite it. Looks like a nuclear explosion.
That's the general idea,
Katie confirmed.
We used them in Vietnam. The Soviets used them in a border dispute with China in 1969 and in Afghanistan in the 80s. In fact, it is the largest non-nuclear device in our arsenal and in the arsenal of Russia. The Russians call them vacuum bombs.
They both took a moment to collect their thoughts as the waiter placed their main courses on the table.
Can I get you anything else?
He asked. Reese eyed the bottle of wine. I think we're good for now, Katie.
This looks delicious, thank you.
Their server nodded. You think the Russians used an FAE to control an outbreak? Reese asked when their waiter was a safe distance away.
Yes, but I believe there's more to it.
Such as?
It's possible these outbreaks are not naturally occurring.
Reese slowed his chewing and chased the tender meat down with a large sip of wine. You think the Russians were testing a bioweapon on villagers in Africa, and when they got what they wanted, they cleaned it all up with an FAE?
We know that back in the Soviet days, the Russian military began collecting various strains of hemorrhagic viruses in Africa. They were and still are embedded in a host of African nations. I think they took samples back to the Soviet Union and weaponized them. More information on the Soviet bioweapons program has come to light in recent years. It even had a name, Biopreparat. We are now finding out that there were hemorrhagic virus outbreaks in the Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s that were covered up. These are tropical diseases, Reese, not something you find outside Africa. The Russians were weaponizing some of the deadliest pathogens known to man. They also needed to test them. What better place to test a bioweapon than in a place where its effects would look like a naturally occurring event to the rest of the world? They refined their weapons in human test subjects, and if it looked like it was going to spread, they wiped the test village off the face of the earth.
Reese took it all in. And you want to expose it?
I do, but I need proof. I need to talk with a doctor involved in the program or a pilot who dropped a bomb.
And what brought all that up to begin with? Reese asked.
There was another outbreak.
In Africa?
Yes, in Angola. Every time hemorrhagic fever breaks out, the World Health Organization is alerted. The CDC monitors the outbreak. They do what they can, working with NGOs to treat infected people and contain the spread. Depending on the severity, Haley will take a team in to assist and bring back samples to study and compare to previous outbreaks, looking for mutations. Viruses adapt, just like the enemy, Reese,
she said, framing it in terms he would understand. Do I remember that her husband worked at Fort Detrick? A scientist or doctor as well, right?
Ah, you do pay attention when I talk about my friends.
Steel trap, Reese said, tapping his temple with his finger and giving her a wink. What are your next steps?
I need to track down some Russian defectors.
There's nothing I can do to discourage you from doing this, is there?
Nope.
I didn't think so. Well, be careful. While you were working to prove that a major world power violated an international bioweapons treaty, I have another week of training. My class is going to Harvey Point in North Carolina. That might be classified, but if you want any specifics, you can just Google it. All the information is out there in cyberspace. I know a lot of the instructors. It's the improvised weapons course, James Bond and MacGyver stuff. The grad students love it.
Well, don't you go getting all smitten with any of those young female spies,
Katie said, pointing her fork at the former SEAL. Speaking of smitten, Reese said, pulling a box from his pocket. It's not a ring, so don't get nervous, he said, smiling. Just a little something. Katie put her hand to her heart.
James, you did not have to do that.
She opened the box and looked down at a gleaming diamond pendant in a platinum setting with chain.
But I'm glad you did. It's beautiful, James. I love it.
I know I missed your birthday while I was away, and I wanted to say I'm sorry.
You're sorry for what?
For leaving the way I did. I was so focused on the mission, I didn't stop to think about anything else. I had the opportunity to go after Gray and finish it. I couldn't have him coming after you again. Katie saw the candlelight reflected in the dark green eyes of the man who had killed for her. She swallowed, knowing that he was capable of intense violence and intense passion. She had first-hand experience with both. I had one of Wraith's outfitters bring it down from the Northwest Territories. I had no idea Canada was such a big player in the diamond industry. Jonathan Hastings knows Martin Katz, so he set the stone for you.
So fancy, she said. I had no idea you had such refined taste.
Katie pulled the stone from the box and brushed her blonde hair aside as she tilted her head to clasp the catch behind her neck.
Well, what do you think? She asked.
It's striking, but not nearly as stunning as who's wearing it. You look beautiful.
Oh, stop it, Mr. Reese. You are going to make me blush.
What do you say we settle up and get out of here? Reese asked.
You think this diamond means you're getting lucky tonight?
One can hope.
I thought you told me that hope is not a course of action.
I did, hence the diamond, the former frogman said, pointing to the rare gem around the reporter's neck.
Your place or mine?
Katie asked with a gleam in her eye. Reese signaled the waiter for the check. Yours is closer.
We can have dessert at my condo.
I'm in. What are you serving?
You're looking at it.
Chapter 14. They hit the street arm in arm, bundled up against the evening chill. Katie noted Reese's eyes scanning up and down the street, moving their way back over the windows and rooftops. Old habits die hard. He had been a little more on edge lately, perhaps due to the CIA training. Katie knew it involved a lot of basic spy tradecraft, surveillance detection, driving, and asset assessment and recruitment. Katie had been unsuccessful in getting him to open up about his trek across Siberia. She knew he was alone for 6 months and had somehow made it from Medny Island off the Kamchatka Peninsula, more than 1,000 miles into the interior in search of his prey. She could only imagine the demons he'd wrestled alone, cold, tired, and hungry. How he had ventured from the Russian interior to the Central African Republic remained a mystery. She knew that from the American embassy in Bangui, the CIA had stepped in and brought him home. Since his return, he'd made a point of taking her to the range and running drills with her Glock 19 and Bravo Company AR topped with an Aimpoint Micro Red Dot optic. She was pleasantly surprised that tonight's gift was jewelry and not a blade, gun, or weapon of some sort. Both her firearms were legal in Virginia, but if she forgot and drove over the invisible boundary into the District of Columbia, she risked imprisonment. Beware of the government that fears your guns. In less than the distance of a foot, she'd go from law-abiding citizen to felon. Citizens could be trusted in Virginia, but not in D.C., though even that could change. Virginia had been trending away from the state motto so boldly emblazoned on their official state seal and flag, Sic Semper Tyrannis, thus always to tyrants. She'd written a few articles for Town Hall and National Review on the irony of politicians calling to defund the police while surrounding themselves and their families with armed security paid for by the taxpayers. More often than not, these were the same politicians taking active measures to ensure private citizens could not own firearms. The irony seemed to be lost on the mob, but not on Katie. She proposed that any politician who supported legislation to defund law enforcement should also be responsible for funding their own security, how they could live with themselves in a constant state of hypocrisy Katie would never comprehend. As long as she had a platform, she was going to hold them accountable. That was the responsibility of a free press, or what was left of it. Knowing that husbands or boyfriends were inevitably the worst teachers due to relationship dynamics, Reese had his buddy Ox come up to run them through drills in individual and team tactics, working barricades, training in vehicle dynamics, room clearing, malfunctions, tactical communication, and combat medicine. Rick Ox Andrews had been around the block a time or two. Closing in on 60 years old, he'd earned his nickname as a young ranger weighted down with a mortar tube across his shoulders and belts of linked M60 ammo crisscrossing his chest, sprinting across the Port Salinas Airport runway in Grenada. He'd eventually serve as a sergeant major in Delta Force before he retired into the waiting arms of Ground Branch, continuing to put rounds into terrorists and insurgents the world over. When not deployed with the CIA, he trained up new recruits stateside at the farm and conducted more specialized training at a black site in Florida. As luck would have it, he was running the basic rifle and pistol courses for Reese's clandestine services class and was available to help teach Katie the way of the gun. Katie was a quick study and was feeling more and more comfortable with her pistol and rifle. She learned to win the fight before rendering aid to her partner, regardless of how horrific the wound. She now had rats tourniquets in her purse, car, and condo. At home, they trained to both barricade in place and clear the two-floor structure. Reese had even made them test out their pistol and rifle-mounted lights, shining them against the off-white walls to ensure the bright beams wouldn't reflect and blind them in a stressful situation. Ox also ran them through scenarios in personal protective detail tactics and vehicle dynamics, with Katie as the principal moving to cover in the event of an attack. Katie thought a lot of it was overkill. Then she remembered being bound and gagged on the floor of Secretary of Defense Hartley's Fisher's Island mansion, being thrown to the ground on the streets of Chinatown in L.A. with an assassin moving in for the kill, and taking aim at a Russian mafia hitman with a rifle through a sliding glass door of the Hastings's Montana home. It did not escape her that the common denominator in all of that violence was Reese. The devastating loss of his family was directly related to the weapons and tactical training he was so intent on putting her through. She had come to terms with the idea that being with Reese was inherently dangerous. Could she live a life of constant vigilance? The closer they became, the more she found herself asking that question. She also knew he longed for the wilds of Montana and Alaska. With a country that seemed more divided with each passing day, she was more amenable to leaving her life as a journalist behind and moving with Reese to the mountains. That meant abandoning the possibility of hosting a primetime cable news show, but it would allow her time to focus on research and writing. Maybe it was time? Would Reese begin a new life with her? Would he start a new family? Those were questions she had yet to explore. She knew he wasn't ready. There was something he still needed to do. She could sense it. She had respected his privacy and not pushed. There was still a demon in Reese's crosshairs. Katie moved to Reese's left side, his support arm pulling her close, leaving his right hand free to go to the gun, his mind subconsciously noting cover, concealment, and avenues of egress, storing the information away in the event he needed it. To Reese, it was as natural as breathing. Even with his preliminary and secondary scan of the area, Reese didn't notice the nondescript dark blue minivan with Maryland plates half a block down. Nothing made it seem like anything other than a run-of-the-mill grocery getter for a local soccer mom. It certainly did not stand out as a specially designed rolling surveillance vehicle with miniature cameras installed and concealed to record in 360-degree high definition. "Target's moving." A man dressed in the dark casual clothes of the season said into a mic attached to an encrypted radio.
"Copy. I have visual,"
a voice responded. The operative in the back of the minivan didn't ask why his team had been tasked with surveillance of a killer who was once the most wanted domestic terrorist in the country. Charlie Crimmins had been out of the military for only a couple of years. The drug charges didn't stick, but they ruined his Marine Corps career. The former sergeant found refuge in private contracting, and right now that paid the bills and let him strap on an M4 in the same places where he'd once deployed as a leatherneck. He'd heard rumors that their target had terminated an entire protective detail on an island off upstate New York before killing the Secretary of Defense a few years back. The former SEAL didn't look so tough now as he walked with his lady friend through the early winter snow. Crimmins felt himself begin to perspire, thinking that one day he might get a chance to take out a frogman. The founder and CEO of Masada wanted him surveilling James Reese. He hoped the company would order him to take things to the next level and install listening devices in the hot reporter's apartment, better yet, audio and video. He'd like to see what she looked like out of those tight clothes they made the female reporters wear on cable news. He'd make sure he suggested that to his boss. For now, he'd have to be content just to imagine. They'd been told to avoid detection at all costs, to get photographs of anyone he met, and to track his every movement. The surveillance team had been reminded that James Reese had a close relationship with violence, and to increase their chances of being witness to the next sunrise, they'd be wise to keep it professional and do their jobs from a distance. If the news reports from 3 years ago were any indication, James Reese was not a man you wanted to cross. Chapter 15. White House Situation Room, Washington, D.C. Secret Service Agent Frank Sharp held the door open and the President of the United States entered the Situation Room. "Keep your seats," the President said as he made his way to the head of the table. Officially called the John F. Kennedy Conference Room, the secure area in what amounted to the basement of the West Wing of the White House had been in operation since 1961. It was installed following the Bay of Pigs fiasco to ensure the executive branch would have a secure facility to monitor sensitive world events and military operations in real time. Finally updated in 2007, the fax machines and computers that were state-of-the-art during Reagan's second term were replaced with encrypted communications equipment and flat screens. The room was layered in sensors to detect illicit monitoring. Lead-lined cabinets for smartphones and tablets were built in by the entrance as a reminder to leave unsecure devices on the outside. 6 black leather swivel chairs were arranged on each side of the rectangular mahogany table, and additional chairs lined the walls. There was one seat at the head. The presidential seal affixed to the wall behind it made clear who controlled the room. This was no Knights of the Round Table. Responsibility and accountability fell on the shoulders of only one man, the commander-in-chief of the United States Armed Forces. The president had entered precisely at 6 o'clock a.m., balancing a cup of coffee he'd been handed on his way into the secure conference room. Veterans of previous administrations sometimes still called it the sit room, a term this new generation only knew from books, movies, or fireside chats with their grandparents. It was now called WHISR, for White House Situation Room. The young president glanced at his watch, still set 5 minutes ahead, and smiled at the memory of his father. The room itself was really a collection of rooms manned by a rotating team 24/7, 365 days a year. The staff was assigned for 2-year cycles and occupied a watch floor just off the main conference area, where they constantly monitored world events for the National Security Council. There were additional offices and breakout rooms for private calls and conversations, one of which had been immortalized in the photo of President Obama's national security team the night U.S. Special Operations Forces killed Osama bin Laden. Though the area occupied more than 5,000 square feet, it still felt surprisingly cramped to those who met there to discuss the government's most sensitive secrets. President Alec Christensen ran his hand down his bright blue tie out of habit and leaned forward in his chair. "Thank you all for coming. I know this is not our usual morning crew, but the Vice President is attending a funeral in Japan, and I wanted to have a more limited discussion today." The President still found it odd not to shake hands with everyone, but the previous year's coronavirus pandemic had shifted some of the country's cultural norms. The nation had still not recovered from the devastating impact of an almost complete economic shutdown. It was Alec Christensen's job to lead the way back to financial prosperity and create the conditions for small businesses to revive. The country had seen technology giants flourish, increasing the distrust between rich and poor, a divide exploited by both parties for political gain. As a Democrat who came from the 1%, the president was acutely aware that any move he made would always be scrutinized through the lens of his past life, privilege offset by service in Afghanistan. During the economic shutdown, the power of big business and the technology sector was highlighted on a daily basis. Blue-collar workers read headlines to learn a tech mogul dropped $165 million on a Beverly Hills mansion for his new wife, while regular people wondered how they were going to pay the rent and feed their families. Disdain for the ultra-rich grew, their wealth increasing as unemployment soared. The middle class had been decimated, and there were those who blamed a progressive ideology that advanced its base only if Americans became increasingly dependent on government. Christensen understood the theory. Before his foray into politics, he would have categorized it as a fringe conspiracy, but after 15 years in the swamp, he now understood the draw of absolute power for power's sake. This game was all about control. It was the president's job to bring the Democratic Party back to the ideals that embraced the values of working-class American voters, the people his party claimed to represent, but who in reality had been left behind for Wall Street, Hollywood, tech titans, and media elites long ago. If he succeeded, there was still hope for the country. A predecessor of his had run on a campaign of hope and change, only to further commit the United States in the Middle East and escalate a drone war that fed the enemy's recruiting efforts. If Afghanistan had taught the new president anything, it was that the country needed more than hope. It needed a leader. The president went around the table greeting the participants by name. His national security advisor sat to his right, across from the director of national intelligence. His White House counsel shuffled papers opposite Janice Motley, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The president's eyes settled on a man to her left and one of the only people not usually present for the president's morning briefing.
"Mr. Rodriguez, thank you for taking the time out of your morning to be here. I know you have a full plate running the Special Activities Center."
"Of course, Mr. President. It's an honor."
"Greg," the president said, acknowledging his national security advisor. Greg Farber's dark blue suit and red tie were offset by prematurely white hair that lent him an air of distinction usually befitting a much older statesman. He'd been a major in the Army's Reserve JAG Corps, which let him practice law in the private sector between government appointments in both Democratic and Republican administrations, to include chairing a commission on justice reform in Afghanistan and a successful term as the Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs.
"Before we delve into the PDB, Farber said, referencing the highly classified president's daily brief, "we wanted to convene this working group. The administration is conducting a review of the past extreme rendition programs run by the CIA and targeted drone strikes by both the CIA and armed forces.
Motley's face betrayed nothing, but Terence Lowe, the director of national intelligence to whom she reported, turned to her and interjected.
It is time to take a look at these programs to determine what lessons we can learn from the past as we forge ahead.
Motley nodded. Director of National Intelligence was a position created out of the 2004 Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act. Prior to 2004, the director of the CIA had overseen the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Now the CIA director was solely focused on her agency, while the DNI was responsible for 17 different intelligence agencies, to include the CIA. The DNI also produced the PDB, the most exclusive and restricted document in the world. Terence Lowe was new to the job. He'd been a SEAL admiral and the commanding officer of the Joint Special Operations Command the night his forces had crossed into Pakistan, targeting the world's most wanted terrorist. After his tenure at JSOC came to a close, he had accepted an offer from his alma mater, Texas A&M University, to serve as president. There, he quickly built up his democratic bona fides, publishing a popular SEAL leadership book and becoming a roundtable regular on the more progressive Sunday morning political talk shows. Some suggested he was building a resume in the hopes of becoming a vice presidential pick to help turn Texas blue. Instead, the president had decided on a female running mate from Florida to bring that swing state into play. He still wanted to reward the former flag officer for his support, which is why he now sat at the commander-in-chief's left side. Some editorials were already suggesting the retired admiral planned to challenge the new president in the next election cycle. Lowe had given Motley a heads-up prior to the meeting, so she was prepared to field any questions that came her way. She and Vic were the only two holdovers from the previous administration in the room, and both agreed with the need to continually assess the effectiveness of their programs. "Just to be clear," the president said, "I want to ensure we are conducting ourselves in a manner befitting the ideals we want to exemplify to the rest of the world. We now have 20 years of data to examine. It is imperative we weigh the results against the unintended consequences. Just because we've always done it one way doesn't mean we will always continue to do it that way. This briefing serves as much as an education for me as it does for all of us to study a decades-old program spanning what is now 4 administrations."
"Thank you, Mr. President," Farber continued. "I think all of you know Mitch Cohen, White House counsel."
Mitch pushed his wire-rimmed glasses up onto the bridge of his nose and cleared his throat. His wrinkled suit looked like he'd slept in it, which he probably had. A thin man with unkempt hair, his appearance had caused more than a few to underestimate what was a superb legal mind. During his time at Harvard Law School, he clerked for a justice of the Supreme Court of Israel when they heard a challenge to what their press called chisulim, eliminations. Though his success in private practice focused on commercial litigation, intellectual property, defamation, and antitrust trade regulation, he'd never forgotten the lessons he'd learned in the land of his parents' birth, a country his grandparents had helped carve out of the desert when the tattoos on their forearms were just beginning to fade.
"As you are all aware, the legal basis for both our extreme rendition program and our targeted strike program comes from the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, passed into law on September 18, 2001. The oft-cited prohibition on assassinations from Executive Order 12333, United States Intelligence Activities, does not legally apply to legitimate military targets. It applies to heads of state. The targets are selected by our 17 intelligence agencies led by the DNI, along with intelligence from the DOD, CIA, NSA, NRO, and NGA. Our criteria was based on the Israeli program, but unlike the United States, the Israeli intelligence services and military branches were given direction by their Supreme Court. All eliminations require adherence to 4 criteria. 1. The target must be designated a combatant, and more importantly, the targeting agency must have evidence that the target is a combatant.
Two, the targeting agency must present reasons why arrest is not a feasible course of action. Three, the targeting agency must consider collateral damage. And four, there must be an investigation after the fact.
Excuse me, Mitch, the president interrupted to address the group. I want to run a cost-benefit analysis on these strikes and renditions. Are they worth the return on investment, not of the missile that kills them, but of the political and moral capital of the United States? Are we creating more terrorists for our next generation to fight, both at home and abroad?
The president's wording struck Vic as peculiar. At home? Targeting on U.S. soil? If anyone else noticed, they did not bring it into the discussion.
Go ahead, Mitch. In the United States, we have operated by three principles since the attacks of September 11, 2001. In accordance with the AUMF, a targeted individual must pose an imminent threat to the nation. Their capture must not be feasible, and the operation would be conducted in accordance with the principles set forth in the laws of armed conflict.
But no requirement to investigate after the fact. It was a statement, not a question.
No, Mr. President.
Christensen looked to the DNI.
Admiral, in your experience at JSOC and since coming on board as DNI, have we followed those three requirements?
Yes, Mr. President. The collateral damage assessments are crucial to a green light. Our policy is not to authorize a strike if there is the possibility of any non-combatant casualties. The enemy knows this and have incorporated that information into their order of battle. They keep women and children close. I'm not saying we haven't made mistakes, but collateral damage is always at the forefront of the decision-making process.
Thank you, Admiral. Mitch, please continue.
Yes, sir. The President has the authority to authorize targeted elimination operations and indeed has the responsibility to do so, which is derived from his constitutional authority to protect the American people. Targeting a U.S. citizen is lawful if that citizen has joined Al-Qaeda or an associated terrorist organization or is providing support for imminent terrorist operations. The Supreme Court has found that the use of force is justified against U.S. citizens who have taken up arms against their country or pledged allegiance to a terrorist organization. It is consistent with the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. Targeting a citizen posing a clear and present danger would not violate criminal provisions, nor would it constitute a war crime. Congress has authorized the President to use all necessary and appropriate force against Al-Qaeda and its associated terrorist organizations through the AUMF. Also supporting this opinion is the national right to self-defense via international law, specifically UN Charter, Article 51.
Are there any territorial parameters? The President asked.
Sir, the AUMF does not specify geographic limitations. It's termed a non-international armed conflict.
What constitutes an imminent threat?
If there is a gray area here, that's it, sir. As we all know, war with proxies, non-state actors, and super-empowered individuals like bin Laden is not a conventional war between nation-states with clearly defined areas of operation. Terrorist organizations are continually planning. If they conducted an operation in the past, there is a high probability that they are still in the network and planning future attacks. Therefore, a targeted elimination would not be an act of revenge, but an act of self-defense to protect the American people from violence.
If I may, sir, Farber interjected. The concept of imminence is subject to interpretation, meaning it must be formulated and argued. Does imminent constitute a day, a week, or a month? And if there is no guarantee that a window to strike based on actionable intelligence, which might also be the only window, will align perfectly with a predetermined criterion of imminence.
Thank you, Greg, the President responded, turning back to the White House counsel. If it has been determined that members of a terrorist organization have planned attacks in the past, then legally, whether a day has passed or 20 years, they remain viable targets. Is that correct?
Legally, yes, Cohen answered.
And rendition operations fall into that legal framework?
Yes, sir.
providing adherence to the law of war principles, necessity, distinction, proportionality, and humanity, i.e. collateral damage.
Have they forfeited their rights as U.S. citizens? Admiral Lowe asked.
Yes. Actions hostile toward the United States constitute a forfeiture of citizenship. Legally, they would still be targetable with lethal force due to imminent threat, but to answer your question directly, a U.S. citizen gives up his or her citizenship, what the law calls a loss of nationality, when he or she engages in hostilities against the United States. U.S. citizenship does not guarantee immunity in armed conflict. The Supreme Court has held that the president may authorize lethal force against a U.S. citizen who is an enemy combatant. It is considered an act of treason, a capital crime. A lawfully targeted elimination is consistent with the principles of national self-defense. The important takeaway, Mr. President, is that lethal force cannot be used as a punishment for past acts, only to prevent future acts, as with Admiral Yamamoto in World War II.
I'm clear on the legality.
Ms. Motley, the president said, addressing his CIA director,
what is the position of the CIA?
Mr. President, Motley said, my organization operates in accordance with strict criteria. The target is confirmed as present, and there are no combatants within the blast radius. Capture is not feasible. The foreign government is not capable of addressing the threat to the United States, and no other reasonable alternatives exist.
And in terms of effectiveness, are we just creating more terrorists in a game of whack-a-mole?
Janice Motley had risen through the ranks on the Hill, first as a legislative assistant before becoming the lead staff attorney for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. It was in that position where she had caught the eye of the then CIA director, who began grooming her for an executive position in America's premier intelligence organization. She would eventually become the staff director of the SSCI before accepting a position on President Obama's National Security Transition Team, which would lead her to acting director of the National Clandestine Service and then into the role of America's top spy. She was the second female director in CIA history and the first African-American woman to hold the position. Those who briefed her would walk in familiar with her background and reputation as one of the smartest people in the Beltway. They would walk out with a newfound respect. In addition to being a brilliant strategist, she was tough as nails.
That is certainly a probability, Mr. President.
Then why do we continue to execute a policy with long-term results inconsistent with the investment?
Without missing a beat, the director of the CIA answered the query.
Previous administrations have continued the program and even escalated it to keep the enemy off balance, Mr. President. Our signals intelligence supports the contention that while it does assist in enemy recruitment efforts, it also continues to disrupt the planning process. I'll have my office send over a classified white paper detailing the threats to the homeland prevented by the strike program.
It's insurgent math, Mr. President, Admiral Lowe offered.
Insurgent math?
For every terrorist killed, we create 10 more. Stan McChrystal arithmetic, Mr. President.
I see.
Administrations of both parties have operated under the president's constitutional authority to protect the nation, Cohen added. These actions are supported by al-Awlaki v. Obama and Hamdi v. Rumsfeld, the inherent right of the United States to protect itself under international law, and the congressional authorization for the use of military force against AQ and associated groups.
I'd like to hear Mr. Rodriguez's thoughts, the president said.
In his early 50s, Vic was the most junior member of the group. He remembered asking new members of his Special Forces ODA for their opinion during debriefs when he was a young SF captain with 7th Special Forces Group. The president was a veteran and was doing the same thing.
Sir, my team has studied this at length in accordance with the Office of the General Counsel at CIA. As you are aware, my department offers another option if the conversation in question is specific to the effectiveness of using unmanned aerial vehicles to deliver a lethal payload. The enemy can use Google, just like the rest of us. They have studied our tactics and know exactly what we just discussed in this secure conference room.
They know our aversion to collateral damage, which is why you rarely find senior Al-Qaeda or ISIS leadership alone. They surround themselves with non-combatants, specifically women and children. My office offers a different option, one that is much more personal, and also more dangerous from a commitment of forces standpoint. A single operative, or a small team from my side of the house can, at times, be a viable alternative.
The president looked at his national security advisor and then back at the leader of the CIA's paramilitary division.
Assassins? No, Mr. President. Hunter killers. Ground branch operatives who understand the nature of the conflict necessitates them getting close to eliminate the threat, limiting collateral damage that can't be positively identified from a Reaper firing a hellfire at 50,000 feet. A covert action statute authorized under Title 50 of the U.S. Code is an option we've exercised in the past.
Director Motley.
Mr. President, this agency is not in the business of creating more terrorists. The targeted killing program under President Obama rose to levels inconsistent with desired end results. Human intelligence networks with proxy forces targeting the enemy run by ground branch operators are high risk, but they lower the potential of creating more terrorists vis-a-vis the insurgent math Admiral Lowe referenced. When a hellfire hits a moving vehicle from out of the blue, there is only one country to blame, the United States. An IED or well-placed bullet, on the other hand, well, responsibility for that type of operation offers plausible deniability.
Alec Christensen leaned back in his chair and touched both forefingers to his lips.
My duty as President of the United States is to protect the American people. Having fought in Afghanistan, I am distinctly aware that we now have soldiers patrolling those same mountains who were not even born on September 11, 2001. They are fighting the sons of men we targeted in the opening years of the war. It is my job to see that the grandchildren of those I fought don't put Americans in the sights of their AKs. Find me solutions. I want a briefing on the disposition matrix, the kill list, for lack of a better term, with best and worst case scenarios attached to each target. And I want options other than UAVs, he said, looking directly at Vic. Greg will coordinate a follow-up meeting. Now, let's go through today's PDB.
For the remainder of the briefing, questions were directed to Motley and Lowe by the president and his national security advisor. Vic's mind focused on the fact that his office might be getting a lot busier in the weeks and months ahead. It scarcely registered that the president's daily brief contained information on a hemorrhagic virus outbreak in Angola and that 457 people had perished before it had been contained by the World Health Organization. Director Motley and Vic Rodriguez exited the Situation Room and took the stairs up to West Executive Avenue, where the director's motorcade was waiting to take them back to Langley. They did not speak until the heavy door to the up-armored black Suburban closed behind them.
That was interesting, Vic said.
Motley nodded, still deep in thought.
I know you have teams downrange working through host nation forces, but from the tone of the briefing, we might be taking a more unilateral approach.
It certainly sounded like the president does not favor relying on UAVs as the preferred method of engagement,
Vic agreed.
I'll have counsel compile a history of the legal justifications for each targeted elimination and rendition since the AUMF. We certainly don't want any of our people in the hot seat at the change of administrations, like we had with enhanced interrogations.
That she immediately thought of protecting those on the ground doing the nation's work was why she had the respect of the case officers, paramilitary officers, and contractors she led. It was a rare quality in Washington.
I agree. I get the feeling the president is after more than just finishing what was started under the Bush administration,
Vic noted.
I had that feeling as well.
Did you catch the U.S. soil comment?
The former Special Forces officer asked his boss.
I did.
There's something else at play, he said.
What do you make of it?
I think it has something to do with James Reese.
Chapter 16. Denver, Colorado. Dr. Ali Reza Ansari pulled his rental car close to the curb in front of the aging home. A green Subaru, extremely popular in these parts, was parked in the driveway. Ali noted that it had not been backed in. The bike was on the roof rack, signaling that it was safe to approach. Still, Ali was cautious. If the FBI were on to them, this would be the time they would make their arrests, before the deadly virus could be replicated. Ali had supervised the construction from afar. The Hawala network transferred more than funds. It passed information. The network of couriers had no idea what they were passing or why. The messages had been hand-carried from Switzerland into the United States. Ali suspected he would have to make a few adjustments, but as long as all the materials were there and the monkey kidney cells had been prepared as he had instructed, he would be able to complete the next phase of the operation. His priority was to use the scanning electron microscope to ensure the cells contained no contaminants and exhibited the stable growth factors necessary to cultivate the virus. He had informed Biodyne that he'd decided to take 2 weeks and tour the United States before returning to Europe. He would be reachable for Zoom conference calls and would be answering his emails. The drive from the East Coast had taken 4 days. He could have done it in 2, but he'd explored along the way, not because he was interested in the sights and history between the Atlantic seaboard and the Continental Divide, but because he was looking for surveillance. He was certain that the Americans were not conducting physical surveillance, but these days, with drones and the interconnected web of the surveillance state, it was nearly impossible to tell if they were tracking you electronically. Ali had always been careful. All his military, intelligence, medical, and business training had culminated in what he was about to do. This was his moment of truth. Ali approached the front door and knocked 3 times. The door opened immediately. The young student had been eagerly waiting.
"Assalamu alaikum," Sebastian said. "Never use Arabic or Farsi with me," Ali said, pushing past the young medical student and making his way inside.
Worn hardwood flooring in dire need of attention led to a small living area, where a couch too small for the space faced an old brick fireplace that at one point had been painted white in a failed attempt at modernization.
"Do you have a cell phone?"
Ali asked.
"Yes, but it's in my apartment. I've never taken it here."
"Good," Ali said, still weary, as he entered the small kitchen. An avocado-green refrigerator hummed away next to a 4-burner electric stove, and a microwave sat at an angle on the rust-colored countertop. Ali parted the thin drapes above the sink and looked into the street beyond the yard. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. No vans with tinted windows, no unmarked Crown Victorias desperately trying to fit in.
"Show me," Ali said.
Sebastian led the way to a door off the hallway and unlocked the deadbolt. His hands trembled for just a moment in anticipation. Ali knew all about Shahram Pahlavi. The regime had groomed him since birth through his parents, who were long-term penetration agents.
The Americans were so stupid.
Why they kept allowing the sons and daughters of those who wanted to destroy them inside their country baffled him. You did not see Americans flocking to Iran, Russia, China, or North Korea to conduct subversion operations and change the fabric of those societies. That is why those countries would endure, and why America was doomed to fail. Shahram seemed eager to please. By design, he knew next to nothing about the Biodyne executive who now followed him into the makeshift lab. No name, no background. Ali already had a plan to kill him after his usefulness expired. Ali surveyed the virology lab. Clear plastic sheets, the ventilation system duct-taped to the outside vents, the state-of-the-art lab equipment he had ordered through intermediaries was all set up and running.
"I need to check the cells," he said.
Sebastian tapped the space key and brought the computer monitor to life. The high-resolution black-and-white image came into focus, displaying what looked like a worm with one end curled into a ball.
"Just as I was instructed,"
They've been growing for 28 days. 15 separate cell lines, no contaminants.
Ali moved in front of the keyboard and zoomed in on the cells, confirming what the younger man had told him. Nodding, Ali asked,
"What do you know about Marburg variant U?"
Sebastian swallowed. He knew the story. It was a case study in improper safety protocols when handling level 4 pathogens.
Marburg variant U? His visitor couldn't have a sample of that, could he?
Marburg, a virus first discovered in a lab in Marburg, Germany, in green monkeys from Central Africa. They were working with kidney cells, just like these, Sebastian said, nodding at the cultures just beyond the clear plastic slats.
That's right. That was 1967. Monkey handlers in Marburg, Frankfurt, and Belgrade were all infected. They died in ways the researchers had not seen in their previous experiments. The virus liquefied organs and brain cells. Almost 10 years later, 430 people died in Zaire and Sudan with similar symptoms to what had been observed in Marburg. But this was another filovirus. Ebola. Ebola Zaire and Ebola Sudan, Ali corrected.
I studied Ebola, Sebastian said. Under a microscope like this one, filovirus strains look almost the same.
Ebola's mortality rate is between 70% and 90%. For our purposes, we need something even more toxic.
Marburg?
Not just any strain of Marburg. Variant U.
That is one of the most closely guarded pathogens on the planet. Only the Russians have a strain, if memory serves.
Not just the Russians, Sebastian. With the fall of the Soviet Union, their scientists were more than willing to sell it. China has it, North Korea has it, Iran has it, and most importantly, the Americans have it.
Where did we get this strain? Sebastian asked.
Ali paused.
Where do you think?
Iran?
Instead of confirming, Ali continued.
What do you know about bioweapons?
My studies have all been on virology and immunology, not weaponizing viruses.
I will guide you through this. Before we begin, it is important for you to understand just how careful we need to be. You've done a more than adequate job setting up the lab in accordance with my instructions. What we don't have is a decontamination station. I didn't have you build one because it wouldn't matter. If you prick yourself while handling variant U,